This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/weekendconfirmed.
T-10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Weekend confirmed.
Ignition. Liftoff. Liftoff.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another fun-filled episode of Weekend Confirmed. Actually, episode number 154. It's sort of a shocker. Woo! Right there. Not only number 154, though. Andrea Nay here for her two-year anniversary.
It's so exciting. Yay.
I have no idea what 2 years is. Is it that, like, paper or cardboard or, like, what do you get on your second anniversary?
Apparently alcohol, because
yes,
that's what everyone's drinking.
Fireball cinnamon whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And Shaq News podcaster emeritus, Mr. Zav D'Amatos, there at the end of the table.
Hey, Garnet Lee, you're alive.
I am.
Garnet, I haven't seen you in a long time. Every time I'm on this show, it's you're on trekking off to some unknown land. It's been a long time. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, except for it's a somber day for us as we have one of our mics turned up here. As you may have heard, we had some course corrections at the home office, and both Mr. Jeff Mattis and Ryan Calvano, who have done awesome work for us, are no longer with us, which is a shame, and we're really saddened, and I'm really hopeful that Jeff will have some time and availability to be back and guest in on the show, which, you know, we'll just have to hopefully work that out down the line. And I don't really have anything else to tell you about it, folks, other than we're drinking to kind of buoy our spirits so we can get through an awesome show for you and have a great time and, you know, carry on their memory.
Yes.
Fireball.
I do want to say I worked with both of them as well when I worked with you at Shaq News, and great guys, and they did
great work.
So
they're fantastic.
They'll land on their feet, hopefully.
So moving forward, I had a thought and it just disappeared into a fireball.
Literally
disappeared into a fireball. Here's what we're going to do on today's show, since there's just the three of us. Jeff Cannata, by the way, he's going to be like, I disappear for 2 weeks, I come back, and this is what happens. I see how it goes now. Anyway, we're going to do three segments, probably. I don't know, we could do a fourth segment if there's still time. If we want to talk about, we'll do that. We're going to talk about some Crisis 3, because we didn't really talk about that last time. We're going to talk about some Revengeance, because we didn't talk about that last time. And then there's a bunch of things that have been going on in the world as well. Kelly Santiago leading developer relations for Ouya. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an interesting development, I think. I want to talk about some microtransaction development, because that's a lot of what I do now, is try and figure out ways to make good design decisions. And let me tell you what, it's not as easy as it sounds. It's very easy to sit on the sidelines and throw bricks into the glass house.
I know, I'm one of the throwers.
It's kind of fun, isn't it? You kind of like that, don't you? I like how you have a Christmas mug, by the way. How did you get a Christmas mug?
I pulled the first one that came out. I guess people here are very festive.
I like that. Here at the Atlantis Group in Santa Monica, they're very festive folks.
Very festive.
All right, so here's where I want to start, though. I want to start with the PlayStation 4, because last week's show, obviously, drew some ire from a segment of the audience. Oh, by the way, rewinding a little bit, super, super props to all of you who have shared the love for Weekend Confirmed, either through a review on iTunes or telling your friends. Like, you guys are awesome. Super appreciate it. No, this is not like, it's not like a, oh my God, the podcast is going to go away situation at the moment. It's really more of a, hey, it's a real world for everyone, and it would be really helpful if you could, you know, tell some folks if you like the show. It's like this. If you like the show, tell some folks. If you don't, tell me. I will have a psychological breakdown in public. You will love it. You will love it and make fun of me for it, and then I will try and figure out how to make the show better. And that's really kind of a simple formula. It's worked for like the last 7 years, mm-hmm, all the way going back to 1UP. So, you know, it's fine. I'm in therapy, and it's all good.
You're taking one for the team.
This is a sad show again, guys.
It's not a sad show at all. It's kind of fun. I'm kind of loving it already. But anyway, as far as the PS4 thing goes, here's what upset me about that is, like, I think that it does stand to reason that as many people who reacted strongly to the show as did, then we must have been a little more negative than I intended to be. So I wanted to clarify. I want to talk some about PlayStation 4 because you two haven't had a chance to talk about it.
Yeah.
I'm upset that it was perceived so negatively, because my negative impression was more a reflection of the first 10 minutes. Okay, not the first 10 minutes, because the first 10 minutes was boring because that was all the Vita stuff.
Yeah.
But after the first 10 minutes, the part where we actually got into Mark Cerny talking about the PlayStation 4, I was like, holy crap, this box is really awesome. I was pumped. And then I just wanted more from the presentation. And people were like, oh, we're not there for the presentation. Well, I mean, that is kind of a lot of what we were talking about. And I think it would have been awesome if somehow or other they could have channeled that aspirational nature of the hardware into more aspirational software.
I think that, you know, in terms of the hardware itself and the feature set that it has, bringing Mark Cerny on stage is, if you don't know, is a huge fucking deal. Like, Mark Cerny is a great guy, especially to be a champion for hardware, because the problem that Sony has had for all of their consoles over the last couple of years has been that they build this very complex architecture, and that it makes it very difficult for third-party companies to come in and really take the power out of those consoles to create amazing experiences, which clearly you can make if you look at the first-party stuff that Sony helps develop. Going to a PC-based configuration makes it a lot easier for developers. So that, first of all, is a huge win for them. The share stuff I thought was fantastic. Where I think people may have sort of started falling apart was when, you know, they came out and they did Killzone, which I think looks great. And I think I heard you guys joking that it kind of looked brown. I think it eventually did turn brown and orange because it was dust and fire. However, the problem that I had with that is, like, I just don't give a shit about that franchise. And I think that they're desperate to get people to care about Killzone.
That is a bigger
picture.
I just
do not care about Killzone.
Yeah, yeah. No, I feel the same way. There's nothing. I feel like there's nothing about that franchise that really kind of.
All right, now don't go negative. This is the positive side.
No,
this is PlayStation 4 rocks.
No. Listen, I personally thought that footage looked really fantastic, but
yeah,
I mean, when you're talking
amazing.
About the story, about being excited about the story, like I'm
like,
with Zav,
I'm
not jazzed about like the story, but I think from a graphical standpoint, I thought it looked really great.
Same thing with Infamous. Nate Fox comes out and gives that kind of awkward speech.
That was really weird. They like you're uncomfortable.
Spray. Yeah. It seemed really weird at first because I didn't recognize Nate at first. I thought maybe this was Watch Dogs, because that sort of seems like the same concept of Watch
Dogs.
It is sure. The same concept, almost exactly.
Except in Watch Dogs, you're just, I guess, a guy, whereas in Infamous, you're a superhero. But, I mean, again, that's just another franchise that I just don't really care about. I mean, I tried playing the Infamous games, and I know that people love them, but to me, they don't resonate. So that was another thing that kind of had an issue with.
I'm actually a little surprised by that, because I thought the Infamous games are very good.
Really? I don't care for them at all.
Okay. I think the games themselves are good, but as far as like a franchise that gets me excited, it's not a franchise that gets me excited. And I think we find a lot of really great games out there, but they just don't necessarily have a narrative or a protagonist that really grips people and makes people excited or makes them feel anything.
So we're getting a little sidetracked here. Here's
yes,
the one
we
thing
are.
I wanted to say is that the takeaway for me of PlayStation 4 was this. I was super, super excited by the hardware. And I said this in the video question of the week last week, but I maybe didn't say it during the podcast. I think that the hardware that they showed puts them in position to be dominant in both first party, but more importantly, multi-platform software releases in the next generation. What they are saying they are going to deliver from a hardware standpoint is freaking badass. It's really badass, and it's really agile and able to be developed for by someone who is making a multi-platform title. And I think that's really big for them, and it's a huge reversal from Cell. I mean, one of the big problems with Cell, if you think about it, was so many games during this generation became Unreal Engine games. And optimizing Unreal Engine for the Cell architecture in PlayStation 3 was challenging.
Yeah, it was.
And it really did. I mean, there was twofold. There was challenging, and then the flagship Unreal Engine games were Gears of War games this generation.
Right. And even in major third-party companies that used Unreal just couldn't use couldn't develop in a way that it would work the same way on the PS3 as it did the 360.
Yep.
You know, and other companies and other engines had that same problem. I mean, Platinum had that problem, and even Square Enix when they went to they made Last Remnant and they had that was I believe that was Unreal Engine on
it
PS3
was.
As well.
And actually, Last Remnant is great on PC because that was the one place you could actually throw enough hardware at it to make it run well.
So I mean, there were the thing the hiccups for me were just the games they mentioned. I didn't really give a shit. But the thing that I walked away from was I am really excited about the platform because it shows fundamentally that Sony has learned their lesson on a lot of different way in a lot of different ways.
Okay.
In terms of how they're making the hardware, how they're actually listening to developers, how they're actually creating things built into the hardware to do things that would be a software side thing, like streaming built into the hardware, uploading built into the hardware. This is the same fundamental sort of shift that Microsoft started with, you know, achievements across the board for everything and all those other things. I mean, they've learned their lesson, and it's still February. We're not going to see like the real games that are coming out this year until E3 or after that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not looking. I didn't look at that conference and walk away disappointed. I walked away really excited for what they could do with that platform this year because they just showed tech demos, and like David Cage came on and showed something that looked essentially the same as Beyond at his GDC panel last year, which I was at, and it looked the same. And Square Enix, for fuck's sake, wasted everyone's fucking time by showing the same thing they did a year ago or 8 months ago.
And like, this is why. So that's why last week when we were talking about it, if I came across as down on it, I came across as down because of those things. And people have said, oh, well, this presentation wasn't for you. Well, I would put forth this. That presentation was your global unveiling. That was the global, I'm going to pull the curtain back and finally show you this thing. And when you do that, that's a one-time shot. I mean, that is the time that you show it. It wasn't, someone's actually said, oh, well, you don't understand that was for developers. And like, no, actually developers get presentations.
Yeah.
They get their own private presentations. They get to see the thing ahead of time. They get to know what's going on.
And I mean,
that was the global, translated in 7 languages, simulcast on the internet, over 3 million viewers. That was the big unveil.
I think last week what you were disappointed at was what Microsoft will probably do when they announce the 360 Elijah Wood, which is make it a Hollywood-style event. And that's what I think people expect out of something.
And I don't want it to actually go that far. I really want substance. I don't want just the fluff. And so people will also, I mean, in my closing, in my finishing move last week, I talked about that. I was like, oh, well, here's what I wanted them to do. It wasn't just... I had to simplify it for a finishing move. I don't just want Elijah Wood. I mean, that stupid Kinect thing they did with Cirque du Soleil was a mess. I mean, that was taking things to the nth degree the wrong direction.
Yeah.
There is a middle ground here where you show off what's cool. I need the aspirational games. Here's the thing is, the hardware to me, I don't care that much whose name's on the box. It can be Sony. It could be Sega. It could be Nintendo. It can be Xbox 360, it could be whatever, as long as it's playing games that I want. And so I want to see what's really cool that you're going to do with those games.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I thought it was really interesting what they showed with the Move controllers, particularly the sculpting portion that they were showing, and I really kind of wanted to see more of that.
You want to see more of Media Molecule, like, playing around with...
No.
I don't want to see more of that specific thing, but I want to see more of what they're doing with next-gen, with motion control. I felt like what they showed us was something that is already available now that you can do, and I wanted to see more details. And while it made a pretty presentation to have like the band where they were all like moving their little marionettes or whatever, I didn't get to see like what is that software, what is that actually like, is that game?
That was so Wii Symphony all over again, wasn't it? Or whatever.
That was my bathroom break. I was so bored.
It was a lot of people's bathroom breaks. But what I'm saying is that technology has a lot of really big potential points, and I think that...
Yeah, but how long have you been saying that about Move is my point.
Yeah, like,
that about Move.
Let me ask you a question. Are you saying that Move has a lot of potential, or that using a higher power platform on hardware makes Move more interesting?
I think that's what I'm saying. I think that I want to see what a better platform, like more powerful hardware, can do with motion control. And I want to see really where can that go, besides me like playing archery. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I want to see something
yeah.
really cool. And I think that they have yet to show us that. But as I've said, they're holding all their best stuff for E3.
We have a bit exhausted the fun and games. Just like we've exhausted the fun and games of the first part of this Weekend Confirmed episode. If you stick around, we'll leave PS4 behind. I think that you guys all know where we stand. I wanted to make sure that I was clear that I was excited about it. Zav, if you have anything else to close on, you can do that when we come back, maybe, and wrap it up.
Sure.
How about that? And we will take a quick break. We will come back and dive into the rest of this week's show. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service for 30 days. One audiobook you might consider is All the Rave, The Rise and Fall of Sean Fanning's Napster by Joseph Menn, as narrated by John Rubenstein. This definitive inside account of the file-sharing revolution that overthrew the music industry, All the Rave, reveals the family betrayal, greed, and mismanagement that hijacked one of the most fundamental innovations of the internet era. Named one of the three best books of 2003 by Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated, All the Rave has been out of print until now and unavailable in most formats. And as an added bonus, this audiobook includes a special interview with the author conducted by Susan Bright. That's All the Rave, The Rise and Fall of Sean Fanning's Napster, available on audible.com. So go to audiblepodcast.com/weekendconfirmed for your special offer. That's audiblepodcast.com/weekendconfirmed. All right, everybody, we are back, ready to keep rolling. Unless, Zav, did you have any PlayStation 4 wrap-up? Because I felt like I might have.
Oh, I just wanted to say that Deep Dive, or is it Deep Down?
Deep Down,
Deep
yeah.
Down.
Looks amazing.
Yeah, it does.
I'm super excited about that. And the thing that they really just passed over on the PlayStation event that, unfortunately, Microsoft's going to probably focus on when they announce their console is their camera. The PlayStation 4 Eye was not really brought up.
Dude,
it was just
it's
images.
A cool camera. We actually talked about that last week. Camera. The hardware is really good, and they blah, blah, blah. Okay, move on.
Yeah, and you know Microsoft's going to go on and on about Kinect because it's a name brand that they want to sell, and I think that's going to be it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Microsoft because Sony set the bar pretty high, I think, with the PlayStation 4.
What do you think, just as an aside, to sort of sidetrack the show as I often do. Mm-hmm. What do you think about Capcom and Capcom's strategy in the year moving forward? I mean, obviously Deep Down I thought looked really cool, although it has a lot of the Souls sort of look to it. And then I have to tell you, and I realize it's probably misplaced lust, but I have a tremendous amount of lust for Remember Me. I think Remember Me looks so incredibly freaking cool. And I don't know if it's just the like Blade Runner-esque part of it, or the Tomb Raider / Uncharted sort of adventuring piece of it, or those two put together. But I'm super stoked for that.
I don't know. You know what? I like Capcom a lot because they're a company that, even though when they release a game that's not successful or they seemingly lose money on a product, they still take a lot of risks. I mean, like, Remember Me is a game that they're essentially taking a risk on.
But it's a huge risk.
You know what I mean?
Really?
And after losing so much money with Lost Planet 2, they decided to go back and refine that game and come back and do something new. You know, people did not respond. There were some hardcore fans.
Dark Void.
You know, people did not enjoy that game.
That was such a shot.
Some people love Resident Evil 5. Some people hate Resident Evil 5. Most sane people hate Resident Evil 6 because that was a giant train wreck. But I mean, I like them because they seem willing to take chances. And it's not something that they've been known for, really, at least in the last couple. It's one thing, that they shouldn't be known for based on the amount of success and the money that they've probably lost in some of those products.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at them, you think about their franchises. You think about Street Fighter. You think about Darkstalkers. You think about Resident Evil as a franchise, the key releases in that. And yet here they are with Remember Me and Dark Void and being willing to, push out. As I think that though he has gone, Inafune had a lot to do with really encouraging them to get out and break outside of that mold.
Yeah.
I kind of applaud them for that, and I hope that it does work successfully for them.
Dragon's Dogma was a game when announced, people were like, what is this nonsense?
Total shrug.
Some people absolutely adore that game. I haven't played it myself, so I don't know what it's like, but that's another thing. And this, I mean, it could have been so easy for them to show Resident Evil 7. hey guys, we fixed Resident Evil. It looks awesome on PlayStation 4. They showed a new IP, which people are saying that's probably Dragon's Dogma or Dogma Souls is the joke, or some people are even saying that it could be a sci-fi thing because there was some element in it that looked like it was sci-fi.
Oh, I didn't hear that part. Where did the sci-fi
part come from? Well, just because I think at one point you see like a helicopter and even the logo looks like...
With the dragon?
Yeah, well, there's like a part at the end of the trailer where it looks like there's a helicopter that passes by. It passes by in the sky. There's like a whole thread on this. I think it might have been on Shaq where people were talking about elements that make it seem like it could be a sci-fi game where you're sort of interacting with memories, or people are speculating all this shit.
Weird.
So who knows? Yeah, so we don't know what the game's about, really, but it looked amazing. And they're creating the best named engine in the world, Pantaray. Pantaraid. I think it's an amazing name for an engine.
I think Yoshinori Ono is a fantastic person.
Oh god. Have you ever interviewed him? Oh
yeah. Yes,
oh
I
my
have.
God, he is the best.
He is wonderful.
It was also great to see Ono-san back up on stage, like in seemingly better health and everything in good shape. Like that was feeling mm-hmm. I felt like, wow, this is awesome.
If you don't know, there was a story not too long ago where he talked about him bringing back Street Fighter really fucked him up.
It was crippling. It was crippling. He put so much work into it. He poured so much of himself into that development cycle, mm-hmm. which I can totally get. It is really hard to make a stuff. Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about like what Konami does with Metal Gear by pushing Rising out to Platinum, which I finished recently, or I finished it over the last weekend. You played it, but did you finish it?
I haven't finished it. I got to, what is that guy's name? Morden? Moden? What's that one dude's name who splits up into a bunch of pieces?
Who is funny? So the character
it's like
talking
fighting
about.
Beef jerky. It was the weirdest fucking thing in the world.
That's a quote.
It's like fighting a Slim Jim.
Write it down.
So the thing is that, of course, the big deal, the catch to the game is that you have this slicing mechanic where you can use one stick to show a holographic slice of where your blade will swing, and the other stick to swing it, and you eventually get to this boss who is able to segment his body along slice lines. And so it's basically like you've been learning how to slice people's arms and legs off, and all of a sudden you get to this guy who, like, he can segment his body like that, so you can't slice him up.
Mm-hmm. At that point, that's when I started getting a little frustrated with the game. I think that the fault of the game, based on the review that we had a joystick, Ludwig Kietzmann wrote it, he said that the game he didn't really kind of fall apart until the end, because the last boss apparently is atrocious. But he did say that he really enjoyed a lot of those mechanics where you had to rethink sort of the elements that you learned throughout the experience, which I think is pretty admirable.
So I think this is one of those games that particularly suffers from the review cycle. And by that, I mean that phenomenon that we have as members of the media when we're playing a game under the pressure of finishing it.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all.
They sent that really early.
Well, I think so.
They sent
it
like 3 weeks.
I realize they sent it early.
Konami was so excited about this game because they think it's going to do so well in critically and commercially. They think they sent us like 100 copies of the fucking thing a month ago.
Yeah, we got a bunch of early.
There was
copies.
No pressure to finish that review.
So we did as well. Mm-hmm. But let me finish my thought. My thought is that even when you have the copy there, we are oftentimes in that mindset of I need to finish this game. And this is a game that one of its most critical flaws, and I'm not saying it's bad, but one of its deepest flaws is its lack of teaching you as the player how the systems are expecting you to play the game. So for instance, one of the things you really have to understand about the game, and it never really teaches you, is that it has an offense-based defense system. And by that I mean that there's no defend, and the defense is based on a parry system, and they only show it to you very briefly, but you don't really grok that, oh wow, I'm supposed to try to parry defenses all the time. And the trick of the game is learning that every enemy you face has a way that you can attack at them while they're attacking and defend their attack and gain the upper hand.
Yeah, I mean, the game, I mean, visually it does a pretty good job of explaining that because everyone glows red for a second and you know the attack is going to come.
I agree.
I mean, there's that. I don't think it really becomes an issue, but I mean...
So to address Ludi's problem,
yeah,
the final boss actually, once you know the trick of that and understand that, like, to beat the final boss, you have to do a bunch of the accurate slice things really in the succession. You have to do like five. Well, actually, when I beat him, I did 3, 6, 9, like 14 or 15 of them in a row.
Yeah, I heard it takes a long time to like really wear the final last boss down.
But he's really, so the thing is, he's hard if you just want to go and run around and fight him. But if you think about how to play him, he's actually not that hard, which is why it was good. I put it down. Like I was super annoyed. Like the first time I went to play the super fight, got to the final boss, I was like, screw this, fuck this game, I'm pissed off. And then I came back to the next night and beat it like on the first shot.
Right. I don't know why he thinks it's atrocious. He just told me that he didn't like the final boss. I would suggest people read the review to find out exactly
because
what.
He's kind of annoying. He is kind of the final boss is sort
boss,
of
Luddy?
No, Luddy's awesome. No, I mean like the final boss is kind of obnoxious. He's kind of obnoxious. It's one of those deals where they like give the boss double health and make him like have crazy attacks that are really hard to. You just have to sit back and know when to counter. Mm-hmm. Know when you can get your attacks in. You can only get your attacks in on very small windows and be patient and like take, okay, I get two light attacks here and then I need to fade, or I get two light attacks here and then I need to counter.
This is going to be a bad comparison, but do you, for me, I feel like Revengeance is like this year's Sleeping Dogs. It was like a game that was supposed to be something else that got canceled and then it was sent off to another developer and turned into something else, and it turned out awesome. Like, the game is fantastic. Platinum did an amazing job and working with Kojima Productions. I know 8-4 did the localization for it too, which is, you know, that stuff's amazing as well. I think the game turned out a lot better than I anticipated it to be. I remember seeing it at E3 last year. And I was assigned to JC, our managing editor, was assigned to see it. And we were like, oh, good luck, because it's going to be the worst. And then he came back and was like, you should go check that shit out. And everyone on staff ended up like leaving early meetings to go play this game. It turned out a lot better than I think a lot of people imagined it would. And it's a great game. I love it a lot. I think it's amazing.
It is really fun. I wish they had given me more time to play with the rank and file soldiers, because I think there are so many fun ways to play the rank and file soldiers. And I think that they got a little bit hung up on mini bosses, because there's a lot of mini bosses in the game. And the mini bosses are fun to fight, but it's also fun to be Raiden and be really, really powerful and master the Zendatsu. The Zendatsu is the move where you slice an opponent in half and rip out their like exoskeleton like goo.
The weirdest way to try to describe it. Yeah.
Like, I don't know, like basically you slice someone, like slice the cyborg in half and you rip out their spine, which has like their spine juice in it, and you use their spine juice to recharge yourself.
Yeah,
that's really the way it works.
It's kind of gross, but I wanted to ask you, you had mentioned earlier on in this segment that you were frustrated that the game wasn't really telling you how to play.
Yeah.
But don't you think that people, not all people, but a group, a fairly large group of gamers,
I think that
prefer
the American
a game
people
to not teach you how to do that? Or do you think that's not an accurate statement?
I don't think that's an accurate statement. That's the easiest.
I
just undermined
people,
your argument entirely.
No, I'm not making an argument. I'm really just asking a question. Like, do you think most people prefer to have the game tell them exactly what to do, or do you think most gamers would prefer to figure it out themselves?
So you have to think about the audience we have. I think that this really divides people. I think that there is definitely a number of people out there listening right now who are core gamers who feel that games handhold them way too much, and that that destroys this idea of discovery. And discovery is awesome. I totally agree with it. I totally agree with the idea that more discovery will make gaming more fun, because having that aha moment, when it's a true aha moment and not a, okay, if you do one and two, then you get three, which is not really genuine. You don't really get you don't get that endorphin rush off of like being led to the example. At the same time, to have that real sense of discovery, you have to have a world in which there's an ability to have genuine exploration and genuine ability to grok the ideas of what's going on in the world based off of your exploration. And to explain that, if there are systems in this game, then I have to, if I want someone just to discover them, I have to give them objectives within a design that makes them learn how to use things that they've already done, put them together, and then build as building blocks and do something new. And if I can't do that, then the discovery is just a matter of them banging their heads against the wall until they get something right.
I mean, for me, it's just as simple as you have a visual indicator to tell me when I'm supposed to parry. It could have just been as simple as giving me a visual indicator when, you know, I had to do certain things in boss fights. I think that
By the way,
just
apparently
solve
the drinking word game today is grok.
You've said it twice. I'm just going to keep track.
All right.
Sweet. Yeah,
no,
so
but,
I
no,
mean...
I agree that the when you're talking about new systems, and particularly, you know, an installment in a franchise that has multiple games in it, that has a combat system, and you're changing things up the way that, you know, Revengeance did, I agree that you do have to give visual cues to the player to be like, okay, this is where you need to do this when,
yeah,
at least in the beginning, they kind of give them a training period, and then if they still don't get it after that, it's really on the player.
Well, my point is really that it's, you know, it's the obviously Metal Gear Rising is totally different from the original Metal Gear. I think that when I say that I want visual cues, I don't necessarily want them to be like, the game stops, a long scroll of text comes up and says, this is how to
Dude,
beat people.
F that.
You know what I mean? Like,
totally
the visual cue, a small cue to tell me that something is about to happen is enough to explain to me. And if I don't understand that as a player, then how did I get to the end of the game, by the way, at that point? And second of all, like, there's nothing really to complain about. The game is trying to give you these cues. I haven't played it to the end of it, so I don't know whether or not there's anything there that does do that, so I can't speak to it.
I think the problem, as often comes true with any of these aesthetic-related or subjective measures, is that these generally are the sort of discussions you have where you know what's good when you have it, and you know what's not good when you don't have it, but it's also very difficult to articulate what those differentiating points are. And this is something, I mean, look, I've been doing this for years and years and years, and it's still really, really challenging at times to break that down into pieces. I can tell you that Revengeance is a game where here's another example. I don't think that this sort of curve makes sense to me. In Revengeance, despite the fact that I'm fighting more and more difficult opponents, my combat rank, which I was able to see at the end of the game, went up on average the deeper I got into the game. And it went up because I started to understand better how to play the game. And
yeah, it's generally how video games work, though.
But should it be? Because
yeah.
I was facing more difficult enemies. So I'm facing more difficult enemies throughout the game, but suddenly I'm able to better dispatch them.
Well, you know what this game does better than most games of this genre does? I'm playing DMC right now, Devil May Cry, and that game starts like Metroid. You don't have
yep.
shit, and you have to go find shit, and you become more powerful. The thing that I like about Revengeance is that you are awesome. Like, you're a badass dude, and you get more abilities.
Well, you get more awesome.
You get more awesome, but you're already super powerful, and there's this sense of, even in cutscenes and when he's talking, he just runs right into the fray. There's no hesitation. He is a soldier. He is this crazy guy who's going to kill anything that stands in his way.
Raiden is a kind of crazy, cool, awesome character.
You know what I mean?
Especially
like,
by the end of
there's
the game.
No hesitation. It's just you become more of a tank than a character that is built up to be better at what you start at. It's
yeah.
not like Metroid where you start with nothing and evolve.
Although you get a lot of stuff. I mean, every time
sure,
every
you
time you beat one of the bosses,
sort of stuff.
You
yeah,
also
like,
you gain their weapons.
It's like yeah, it's like Mega Man. But at the same time, you who cares? Like I never really use the Psy or any of the other stuff.
You might
got. Like. You know, the slicing mechanic is great, and the combo stuff that they add into the game is great, but you already start as
I'm of
such
two
a
minds on the,
character.
I'm of two minds on the slicing mechanic. So the thing about the slicing
Don't
mechanic...
Don't talk shit about that slicing mechanic.
Really?
I love that slicing mechanic.
But what's weird is it changes sticks. So it changes the control mapping of the sticks.
Well, yeah, because one of the sticks needs to...
Because
control
one of
the
right, so
blade.
Wouldn't it have been more familiar if the camera had stayed on the right stick and you used the left stick when you grabbed? So what happens when you go into slice mode? By the way, there's a mode that's sort of a slowdown Max Payne sort of thing where you grab a trigger and then you're in like a slice mode, and that brings up this virtualization of where your sword will swing. And when you do, the camera control switches from the right stick to the left stick, and the right stick becomes your slice mechanic. And that it took me a while to get accustomed to that. Now, granted, once I did, I was okay with it. But it took me a little while to get accustomed to that.
Yeah, but then you get accustomed to it, and it works. Like the problem
okay,
with that game in general
fair.
Is that the camera in that game is shit to begin
oh,
with.
Oh, God. The camera's so bad.
Like, I like the game a lot, and I will play the game to the end, but that camera is fucking awful. And DMC does the camera really well because what that game...
No, DMC does the camera okay, but compared to Rising, it's like... Jesus.
It's like comparing apples and Volkswagens. Like, there's totally not even the same fucking thing. You know what I mean? Like,
apples and Volkswagens?
Well, my point is that, like, DMC is more of a cinematic camera where it's pulled out and it's not right up on, right up Raiden's ass. Like, in that game, it's like right up Raiden's ass. It's ridiculous. Like, it turns into a third person game, and especially when you go inside, because the
inside
camera,
Raiden's ass?
There's so many euphemisms flying around.
When you go
right
inside
now,
of buildings in Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, it is so close to the characters that it becomes a big issue, especially the lock-on system does not work very well.
It doesn't work very well.
Whereas,
I agree.
Do you know what? I had a lot of problems. It's like arena. It's more arena based, and I think it's a little. It works a little bit better.
I'm glad you brought up the lock-on system because
and not up Raiden's ass.
One thing that was infuriating me was I was in a particular boss battle, and it was really driving me crazy that the lock-on system, quote unquote lock-on system, was unlocking from the boss and randomly jumping to this annoyance thing that was in the level as well. There was like a boss and an annoyance enemy.
Yeah.
And it would jump from the boss to the annoyance enemy without me doing anything for no reason. I'm like, wait, I want to be locked onto the boss. I need to be paying attention to the
priority.
Priority number one. Yeah. I understand that thing over there, that thing is just here to harass me and try and distract me. I'm not paying attention to it.
It's
Stop trying to move my attention.
Yeah, the camera's not good in that game.
No, it's not. But Rising is fun. I agree. Rising
I like it a lot. And you know what's funny? I don't traditionally like that genre at all.
Really?
I went into, you know, those combo-heavy action-based games. Never really enjoyed them.
Did you ever play Otagi?
Yes.
Oh my God, Otagi was so good. That was I don't really, know why I thought of that, but it's
the
so
From
good.
Software game.
Yeah.
And then the sequel was really good too. I mean, those were good games, but it's never a game that I'll play them and realize that they're great, like God of War, and you know, maybe I'll finish one like I did the first and third God of War games, but I just like never gravitate to it. And I started playing DMC thinking that like, oh, I'm gonna really hate this game, but I actually am really enjoying DMC as well because I think
DMC was fun. I mean, I had some nits to pick. But
also, I'm playing on PC and it's fucking amazing on PC.
That's the place. So that's the thing. Like, Rising is 60 FPS, and the 60 frames per second really does make a difference in the way they employ it.
DMC?
No, DMC is not 60 frames.
On console, it's 30. On PC, it's 60.
Yeah, I know. That's what I was saying. I was talking about console. Because I've been trying to play more games on console. Because I was playing stuff on PC for a while, and people were dogging me for like getting a little PC elitist. So I'm trying to like go back and like go back and forth some. Which is why I played Crysis 3 on 360 recently.
What?
Of all the games to play.
Oh, dude, I'm not trying to keep up with everything. But
fuck. No.
I mean, the CryEngine's just so beautiful on PC, though. Why wouldn't you
it's
do
It's like you just emerged from the sewer.
It's so beautiful.
Oh, come on.
Which
not,
is a level in Crysis,
no,
by the way.
It's not that bad.
It's the worst.
It still looks beautiful on console.
I'm dripping.
Even though it looks more gorgeous on PC.
But anyway, before we talk about that, I had a thought. What was my thought?
Are we
it was about Rising and were we talking about what?
Is that happening?
What?
This.
What? Hearts? Hearts and butterflies and roses.
Exactly.
What's happening right now? So cute. You're such a girl.
I am a girl. It's true. I can't hide it.
Oh, Assassin's Creed.
Mm.
There was an announcement this week.
Box art. So let me preface this with, Ariel just recently finished Assassin's Creed 3, which I watched her play, and we talked about it briefly in passing. I was really surprised by two things. Number one, how buggy the game was, which we'll just set aside.
Sure.
But also, how much of the game was the ship-based combat? Like, and you know what? Every moment, the part that she was in the cities and doing all that stuff, I was like, I don't really care. The parts where she was out hunting in the wilderness, I thought that was kind of cool. The parts where she was on the ship doing the ship-based stuff, I was like, I want to play that game. That game looks really fucking cool.
Guess what?
And by the way, it really does look like Assassin's Creed 4, as we had heard rumors of, will be Connor's granddad.
Pappy? Pappy?
Pappy Connor.
Pappy Connor.
Pappy Connor.
No, I don't think his name is Connor Connor, so I don't know what his last name
is. His name is Edward Kenway. Okay. He's Haytham's father, Connor's grandfather.
We're going to the Caribbean, man, in 1715, Jamaica.
Yes, early 18th century. I have so much I wanted to talk about.
You
want to
jerk my chicken?
And I can't because the embargo doesn't lift until 9 a.m. on March 4th, which is a couple days away.
Yeah.
But the Examiner and a number of other outlets, based on some leaks, I guess, have
leaked information. Yes, it's true.
I've started talking about some of these things, which I think was why Ubisoft tried to get ahead of it by showing the box art and saying, yes, hey, look, Assassin's Creed 4 is a thing. And if it's based around this pirate combat, I think that's awesome, because the challenge that pirate games have had in the past is, how do you meld together the awesome part of being a pirate and commanding a ship and having the ship-based combat with the third-person action game.
And not which having is where it be cheeseball like Treasure Island or Pirates of the Caribbean, right? Here's what I'll say.
And look, even Risen tried, and Risen is like the closest that we've had to those games working, and even it had its challenges.
It's true. The people that I talk to, this is the one thing I'll say that I don't think I'll get in trouble for saying, is that they are saying that if HBO was going to do a Pirates show, that's what Assassin's Creed 4 would be. Imagine like more like grittier, darker, you know, a little bit more rough and tough than, say, your Jerry Bruckheimer flavor of pirates.
The thing that is surprising...
I'm laughing. You don't believe them, or you think it's a weird euphemism?
Well, I didn't know it was a euphemism, but I was more laughing that you were sort of giving me the PR talk thing.
That is the PR talk. That's the talk I got from PR.
Don't give me the PR talk. Screw that shit.
You know what?
What do you think? By the way, Andrea Renee,
I can't really tell
say,
you
though,
what I think.
No, yeah, you can.
I will say
on.
That I think as a longtime fan of the series, and listeners of the show will know
that
I am a longtime fan of the series. I've played every single Assassin's
You think
Creed
Corvo was a
times.
Pussy?
No, I don't. Yes, that's even a franchise. That was a single game.
You think Connor was a pussy? Sorry.
Yes.
I think that...
Use his full Christian name, please.
Well, no, I don't...
I don't know what it is.
I don't think that he was a pussy or a wimp. I think that he didn't have the kind of bravioso that, Ezio did. I think that we are going to see this protagonist be more similar to Ezio than to Connor.
So, can I pull on something there? I think... So, what you're saying is that there was something cool about this Renaissance man... as an assassin.
Mm-hmm.
There's something cool as the pirate as an assassin,
mm-hmm.
but that the Native American as assassin just missed some of that.
No.
It
had nothing to do with him being Native American. It had to do with them setting him up as a victim in the beginning of the game.
Okay.
They set him up as a weak character in the beginning and saying, oh, he...
Well, I did see him getting his ass kicked a couple of times.
Right. Like, he was really victimized in the beginning of that game, and I think that really kind of made you sympathize with him, which I think is good because they humanized him a lot more than previous protagonists in the series had been, which is a really interesting way to take it. But I also think that it made people like yourself think of him as a pussy, for lack of a better word.
I didn't say he was a pussy. That's your words.
I
Those
didn't
your
say
words.
That.
Those are your words.
Rewind the tape. I did
Those
not call
words.
Him that. You said
you just
it
did.
First.
I didn't say that. What are you doing
okay,
about?
I'm not going to argue with you about it.
Although this could go on for another 20 minutes. I do want to say that it's very surprising that this is called Assassin's Creed 4. Black Flag.
I thought that was really interesting,
considering
too.
That it is in the same lineage of the characters of Assassin's Creed 3,
which they said they were going to draw the curtain on. They said they were like, yeah. They said, look, this is the end of the trilogy, we're done with that, we're finished. By the way, the ending of Assassin's Creed 3 was a little bit of a
unsatisfying
ending,
to say the least.
You think so? You thought it was unsatisfying?
I did. Watching Ariel's, like, I was like, you know what, actually, now I really
do you
don't
actually
need to play,
play games anymore, or do you just watch Ariel play?
I do.
Games?
No, I play my games and she plays her games, and we kind of like watch back and forth.
I thought it was
screens.
An interesting move. I think that, you know, if you guys haven't finished the game yet, I'm going to do my best not to give any spoilers, but I thought that they kind of gave you this perception of a choice when there really wasn't a choice, which I thought was a little frustrating, but Assassin's Creed isn't known for letting the player make these choices that affect the outcome.
Sure.
It's not Mass Effect. I did think that they
that
clearly
ending turned out really well, though.
They really clearly left it open to continue the franchise, which I thought was necessary, and I'm really interested to see where they take it. I don't know how I feel about what they're doing with the present day aspect of the game this time around. I feel like it's almost a kind of cheap way to go about it, but they also haven't given many details about it. So I'm being very vague right now because I have to be because I signed an NDA.
And
but
I did not see any of it, so I don't really know. I only go by...
I will say the gameplay, the actual like open world gameplay of it looks phenomenal, and Far Cry 3 developers are working on the game and really kind of helping to improve some of the progression and upgrade systems in the game, which I think is really fantastic.
Do you feel like you want to play another Assassin's Creed game where you're going through cities, finding perches, unlocking the, you know, the hawk sound, and seeing the different spaces down on the world that you go to.
In this new environment, yes. Absolutely.
You
want to
do that again?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm not sure how many times.
Because you haven't seen it yet. I have to tell you, this...
I don't know, but I was as excited for Assassin's Creed 3 as you are about this, and I've kind of... It burned me out. I mean, like, this turning this franchise into an annual thing because it makes money for Ubisoft has really just soured me on it. Not because I don't like businesses, but I just, like, I don't need another one every single year. These are long games. These aren't, like, it's not like Call of Duty, which that's another problem, but it's, like, that's a 5-6 hour experience. And sure, make an annual franchise out of that. I don't give a shit because I'm probably not going to buy every single one of them. But Assassin's Creed, I like the franchise.
You know what, though?
It's like a 30 fucking hour game.
You know what, though?
Really,
for Call of Duty fans, for people that buy Call of Duty and love it, it's not a 5 or 6 hour experience. It's a 100, 200, 300 hour experience.
You're changing the discussion.
I use it as a reference point, but it's not a comparison for the player.
If you want that experience, you want it. If you're not excited about it, you don't have to play it. You know?
I'm not excited about it. I haven't seen anything about it. I saw a box art. So
right.
I
well, this I will say, as someone who has seen it, even though I can't give details, what they're doing in the...
If you say I can't give details one more time, I'm going to slap you for the audience.
Please don't slap me. It's not my fault. I don't want to get in trouble.
That's what she
the
said.
The improvements...
That made no sense.
The improvements they're making and the things they're bringing the best parts from each of the previous installments in the franchise into single game.
You heard it here first. The best parts of Assassin's Creed 1, 2, and 3, they'll all be there in Assassin's Creed 4, but only better.
God, you are not helping.
Hey, I don't.
I'm not here to help.
You're not helping me. People already are accusing me of being a PR mouthpiece in the comments of this show.
Let me ask you a question.
I'm not being a PR mouthpiece. I'm just saying
how good's that Aliens?
I have actually only played a tiny bit of it, so I can't judge.
And how good is it? It's so good.
It's not as terrible as everyone makes it out to be. I'll say that.
Wait, Colonial
really?
Marines?
Yes. Yes.
Oh God, that was terrible.
It's not.
It's
horrible.
Terrible.
It's not as
it
horrible
is.
As everyone's making.
Wait,
it
wait.
To
which
be.
One's worse on the scale? Horrible or terrible?
Horrible is better.
Horrible is better.
No, it's worse. Horrible.
Okay,
is worse.
then it's horrible.
It's bad. It's a bad game. Anyway,
it's not a good game. But
it's not a good game.
A piece of shit.
I don't want
to
sound...
So, by the way, because I forgot, I told people I would nail you to the cross for this.
Oh, what are you nailing me to the cross for?
For the whole, like, Aliens Colonial Marines is going to be a good game thing.
This goes to show that it's really frustrating when you are shown something in a press preview that doesn't get delivered in the game, right? Like, that was one of the major criticisms of Aliens Colonial Marines. The preview that I saw was not the game that was delivered. And there was plenty of people who made those comparisons and showed the footage side by side.
So what do you think about that?
I think that it's shitty. I think that Gearbox really dropped the ball. I think that it was really, like, frustrating as a gamer to be... you know, promised something and delivered something else. I thought that was shitty. And I really think it was frustrating that, you know, Randy Pitchford tried to defer fault to, you know, somebody else. And I
they
think
promised you Mercedes, and then they pulled up with a Kia.
I really feel like he should have just come clean and said, you're right, we dropped the ball. I'm sorry. But I know that that would leave him open for a lawsuit, which is why he didn't do it. But you're right. Like, when I saw that in New York in October, the demo I saw was fantastic. It was great. And then the game that came out was different. You know, and, you know,
and
there
those,
was plenty of videos out there that really
there are
showed
a lot of videos that
showed this dramatic difference between the footage.
I'll freely admit that we hired a freelancer to go see at a joystick in New York and came back with a positive preview because really enjoyed what he saw. And then I reviewed the game and I gave it 1 out of 5. I think it's atrocious. I think it's criminal that Sega sells that game for $60.
It's a mess.
It's a disaster. That game should be pulled off shelves. Like, it is that bad of a game. Not only because the game is so technically horrible, but because it comes with all of this bad taste in everyone's mouth of huge promises of what it was going to do, going to Fox and changing canon because they were going to make this great experience, and delivering something that is just a disaster that Gearbox themselves may or may not have, based on what reports there are, even contributed to developing it. They, like, handed it off to someone else while they made their own thing. Like, What I mean, this is like the hottest news of last month, but I don't...
All of the in-depth reports about how Gearbox, you know, reappropriated resources to go into Borderlands 2 instead of Alien Colonial Marines.
It's all speculative.
Of course it is.
It is all speculative.
But people want to take what they want and believe what they want. I think that there was a wasted opportunity there. What I saw and what they were doing with the franchise and in continuing the story and having, you know, Lance Henriksen come up on stage and talk about it, I thought it was all really cool. And I thought it looked fantastic. And like a lot of people was...
Who's Lance Henriksen again?
Play Bishop?
I'm kidding. That was a big joke from last... You missed that. That was a joke from last time we did the...
Oh, sorry. I didn't listen.
He also is the voice of Admiral Anderson in Mass Effect, in case anyone was curious.
Oh, sweet. I am doing his autobiography, so that's going to help me. It's totally going to help.
I mean, listen, like at the end of the day, I think we all could admit that, you know, we're disappointed. Right? Disappointed. I still don't think it was like a piece of dog shit, though.
Hey, despite who developed
it, I just like
game,
watching you squirm. It's kind of fun.
You like putting me under the pressure, which is fine. It's totally cool to do. I would rather talk about it on the show than have people like throw me under the bus in the comments and not give me a chance to respond.
We all get thrown under the bus.
Yeah,
it's
don't
all good.
Worry. Who gives a shit what people fucking write about this show or any fucking thing? It doesn't matter.
We care.
Who cares about any of it? You know what? Fuck
don't
it all.
Listen to
whatever.
That.
I don't like...
We read the comments. Even though we tell ourselves
now,
not
the peanut
to,
gallery's
we do.
Getting in on it.
We
like,
do.
Who cares?
By the way, those of you in the behind the glass, we can't hear you in the recording. It doesn't come across the recording. It doesn't work like that.
Screaming. I will say, regardless of who made that game, that Gearbox is the one that has the black eye. And whatever they work on next, when they start making lofty promises, people are going to be like, you know, we're going to have to take everything with a grain of salt, which everyone really should until they see something, which is why there's some confusion as to why there were positive previews about Aliens versus the reviews, because we were shown something that was not the final game.
Exactly. And let's not forget, even though they made Borderlands, which I love, they also made Duke Nukem Forever.
And Samba de Amigo Wii.
Which was horrible.
Didn't they make Aliens Infestation, the DS game? That was pretty badass. Wasn't that them?
Did they make that?
I think that was like one of their B teams or something. Or like their name is on it. It's another situation where I think their name is on it, but someone else made it. Maybe it was like InSpace or something made it.
I don't know.
They do stuff like that.
It does. And I don't know if, Zav, you want to talk about this anymore, because you had it as like your sort of topic, this whole subject matter of what we're shown in the media as vertical slices, which is, I mean, by the way, the buzzword for what happened with Colonial Marines is the vertical slice. And the vertical slice is something that's pretty easy to be manipulated, because it is, and it's the same thing that happens in big developer presentations, even like the PlayStation 4 presentation. If I have a case where I can control every variable, I can control exactly where the person who's orchestrating the demo goes, then I can construct a very carefully created scenario scene that looks fantastic and looks like it's being played in live world and looks like it is completely interactive and part of the game engine and using assets and all that kind of stuff, that is very hard to discern that it's not actually that way, or that it was put together purpose built to be deceptive like that.
You know, a good example of this is sort of what happened with Black Ops 2, because I went to a reveal for that game before that game was even announced, like 2 months before, and they showed off a level. And they played it in front of us, and it looked cool. And then they did the reveal, and they played that same level and played it in front of us, and it was cool. Then they showed it at E3 and played it in front of us. Every single time, it was a live demo, but it was exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
Because if you make any mistakes, if you do something wrong, if you let someone else who does not know the controlled environment play it, the whole thing can break. Because it is such a structured demo to show very specific pieces of an experience.
And to be fair, they're not all like that. I mean, they took the Killzone demo on PlayStation 4 to Conan and let him play it. And that was cool. I mean, it demonstrated that, hey, this was actually live in-engine play.
Yeah, and it looks great. Yeah. It's Killzone, but it looks great.
But, well, I mean, but that's not that's a very fair point to make, especially, you know, given what I just said about what I saw at the, you know, AC4 demo. That was a very controlled environment. And based off the information I was given, I was very excited about seeing more and learning more and really seeing where they're going to take this, just as I was excited when I came away from the Alien Colonial Marines demo that I saw, you know, at New York Comic Con. It's really challenging as a member of the press to go to these things and remember and really actively remind yourself, this is what the publisher wants me to see.
Absolutely.
You know? It's really challenging.
It takes a long... Like, having... In my position, what I do is I typically hire a lot of freelancers to go see these demos, and then I have to copy edit their work, and we go through all the stuff step by step to make sure that what they are writing about is exactly what they saw. So we have this process. And I see very few freelancers comfortable with being skeptical of certain aspects of it. And even when I started in this industry, I was kind of skeptical too. It was like, well, it looks great, but of course it's going to look great, right? I think that some things changed. Like working with John Davison, that changed back in GamePro. He was very adamant about, like, you have to make sure that you are completely honest with yourself and your readers. Like, that was something that even when I went and worked with you at Shaq, even like having conversations with other
people. Surprise, John rubbed off on me.
Exactly. So, I mean, like, there are certain things that you just have to know exactly who you're writing for. And you're not writing for the PR people, and you're not writing for any of that. Those, like, the developer, you're writing to be honest with your readers and the people who are reading the material and yourself.
Yeah.
Right. And I do see that is an issue with younger writers or people coming into this industry where they're shown something that looks fantastic and they don't really ask the questions of how things are functioning in the background, or, you know, wanting to see demos multiple times. They see the one vertical slice for 5 minutes and they think that's enough. Like, there's a lot of stuff that needs to go hand in hand with that stuff. I don't know if we wanted to get into this PR block now.
You can take it now. You can run it over to the next segment. Whatever. We're free form.
Sure. I do want to say about AC4, like, although that I'm kind of burned down the series just because they've been so many, I'm not down on it. I'm not like, oh, fuck AC. Like, I want it to be successful.
But, dude, pirates are ninjas. Pirates have swords and guns. Pirates.
I think that what they're doing with this particular installment is they're really, you know, kind of veering off from where all of the other previous games in the franchise have been. And I'm really excited to see it go to a really different, interesting new place.
Yeah.
And really see them stretch their wings as developers and really offering the player unique gameplay mechanics that haven't been involved in the franchise before.
I don't really need to be unique. Like, you know what? Actually, 4 would make me really happy if it could nail being a great pirate adventure with awesome shipboard combat that they had from 3 and great swashbuckling being a pirate on the land in between that.
Yeah, the unique aspect would be at that point the narrative
and
the setting. Like, a lot of the mechanics have already been refined so much. I kind of wish they would just go back to, like, the AC2 stuff a little bit more, because they added way too much stuff with
AC3. I mean, hell, if they
could
come up just the level of, like, Cutthroat Island, I'd be happy.
Yeah, you know.
I just can't say anything. I'm going to get in trouble.
Yeah.
I think Andrew just puked a little bit in her mouth.
Let's
no,
move on.
I didn't. I'm just, like, I'm squealing a little because there's so much I want to tell you, but I can't.
People love hearing that you can't talk about something, by the way, on podcasts.
They're really happy about that.
I'm sorry. You brought it up. I told you I was going to get frustrated when I saw it in the show notes.
Did you play Crysis 3, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, I'm playing it on my 360 right now.
You want to go into that rather, and we'll skip to the next segment for the PR thing, because I think that's going to be a more involved conversation.
So I switched over because...
to console from PC.
And the context of this is that during the PlayStation presentation, I admittedly, it could sound trollish, but it wasn't intended as a trolling comment. It was what popped into my mind was that having seen Crysis 3 on PC, when I saw Killzone 4 on PlayStation 4, I thought to myself, that looks great for a console, for something I can buy and put in my living room. Mm-hmm. But if we're just talking bleeding edge graphics and visuals, I've seen that degree of visuals in Crysis 3 on PC. And to me, that was like, that's kind of a big challenge in that, even going to console, I want my console, when it drops, to be something that's badass enough that if a developer is writing to the console specifically, they can do shit I haven't seen.
Yeah, the last couple of years, we've just been seeing games kind of get dumbed down because PCs are so much more advanced than the consoles. And this is typically what happens very quickly into the generation.
Of course. Of course it's going to happen when
you know what I mean?
Generation.
Like, but I mean, it's starting to become super evident, like Far Cry on 360 versus the PC version.
Dude, Far Cry on 360 is not bad.
It's not bad, but it's good. It's not the same. I mean, there are a lot of frame rate issues for that game.
There are places where you have frame rate
texture
issues.
Texture stuff is a little muddy.
I'm not saying it's bad.
I'm just saying
that
it's a
problem. I think that the average console player sees those differences, though. I think people that play on PC frequently will notice those things more than people who only play on console.
Then why would people give a shit about buying a PlayStation 4 that's going to be more hardware, like, is going to have more enhanced hardware and better graphics?
Wanted to see more cool shit from the software.
All right, well, that's fair enough.
Why you should want to hear more of this show, which we will continue if you stick around. We will be right back on the other side of this break to talk about Crysis 3, the relationship with PR, and I don't know, whatever else Zav has up his hoodie sleeve.
Sure, you can pay $60 if you want to play a video game. But what if you want to play all the latest video games? Try Gamefly.com, the number one video game rental service. Right now, you can sign up for just $5.95, their lowest price ever. Gamefly has over 8,000 titles, including the hottest new releases like DMC Devil May Cry, The Walking Dead, and Hitman Absolution. And here's how easy it is. Just sign up, select your games, and Gamefly will ship them directly to your door. You can keep the games as long as you want, there are no late fees, and you can cancel at any time. Once you're done playing a game, send it back, and Gamefly will send you the next available game on your list. Now, you can also play hundreds of PC games with Gamefly's new Unlimited PC Play, which is free for members. Gamefly also saves you money by letting you try your favorite games before buying them. If you really like the game you're playing, simply click Keep It on the Gamefly website, and it's yours at a deeply discounted price. And if you're still unsure, which you shouldn't be at this point, but if you're still unsure, we're offering our listeners a special offer. This is just for Weekend Confirmers. Go to gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed for an extended 15-day free trial. That's gamefly.com/weekendconfirmed and sign up today.
Wait, what? Ho? Who is that?
What? Jeff Cannata's here. Oh, my God.
Twins, Wendy.
All right. So we were talking about Crysis 3.
We were. You're playing the console version.
I am. Specifically to defuse that argument about whether I was being PC elitist while looking at, you know, the PC version of Crysis as compared to PlayStation 4 dev box version of Killzone. And I have to say, Crysis 3 on PC, pretty fucking impressive.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty amazing. That game is a lot like Killzone to me in the sense that it's always beautiful. It always has very solid ideas and mechanics behind it. Just not a world I'm really interested in playing in, but it is a great world to explore because they put so much care and effort into the engine that they create, and it always looks fantastic.
Let me start off by just kind of laying the groundwork for how impressed I am with this engine. I thought this scene was cool on the PC, but I was really impressed that on the 360... the very first scene starts off and you're on a very, it's night scene. And the way I would, you're not on an oil rig, but it feels like as if you were on like a oil derrick in the middle of the North Atlantic with high seas and a very heavy rainstorm and engaged in a semi-stealth firefight with your opponents. And so you're running around on these like catwalks and industrial things with waves crashing and rain falling and like running through all of that. And what really opened my eyes to the how cool it is what they're doing even on the console version is I get to one spot when I'm running up to a catwalk and stair set that's going to take me up higher into the complex. And as I'm running, the like rain is beating against me and I like all of a sudden when I'm in the rain and I realize that just as they did on the PC version, if there's an overhang over you, that they're modeling the way the rain in the wind is being blown so that when you come under the overhang, you still get hit by some rain, but the way the rain is hitting you changes, and it's as if you had run underneath that overhang. Small point, I realize you can say, like, well, of course it does that, but their visual and sensory immersion is so intense that like it delivers that little subtle move really, really well. It's like you're running up this catwalk. All of a sudden, you're like, "Oh shit, I'm under an overhang."
Yeah, it's really impressive. And the thing that I like about Crytek is that they're not the only ones that is utilizing this engine to create software. I mean, it's not only theirs. They're not to the level of, you know, Epic and Unreal, but other developers are jumping on board.
I think you could argue they are.
Well, I mean, in terms of how many people they have signed up for it. I mean, Unreal is still going to be.
But if you look at MechWarrior.
I mean, that stuff looks impressive. But Sniper Ghost Warrior 2 is coming out soon. I know, you know, but think about it. In terms of a stealth sniper game, what would be better than a lush environment with, you know, very thick trees and large tall grass? I mean, that environment is sort of perfect for that style of game.
And they do the foliage very well.
I mean, it looks very, very, very good. But the thing, and I want to ask you about this because I played Crysis 2 and I reviewed it for Shaq.
So I have not played Crysis 2, much to the chagrin of folks who followed the show.
Now, have you played the original Crysis?
Yes. Played and finished Crysis.
Okay.
Didn't play Crysis 2 for I don't know why reasons.
Did you play 3. The first Far Cry?
Yeah. I love that. Like up to the rocket arm monkeys.
Okay. So the question that I have is where it kind of falls apart for me is when they transition from intelligent AI strategic enemies to nameless, faceless alien drones that have no intelligence and run straight toward you because they're powerful.
Well, so you mean talking about Crysis 3?
Yes.
So I think that must tie into the story because the Ceph who you're fighting, the Ceph are the aliens in the Crysis world. And I kind of, so I didn't play 2. I can't speak to that. The sci-fi foo in Crysis 3 kind of is cool. It's cool enough that I'm like, yeah, this would be like a sci-fi movie. I'd watch this. It would be kind of cool. It's this classic sort of thing of humans gone wrong with alien technology and trying to do too much with it and unleashing terrible ancient evils.
Yeah, but I mean, it's
those
just
themes are the same in Crysis 2 as well.
Are they?
Yeah.
Essentially. And I think that, you know, when you were fighting the, I think it was a North Korean army or the, an equivalent of some such in the first Crysis, it was just so much more interesting to fight these human enemies that were, you know, strategic in the sense that they're squads and they work together and they have AI that is, you know, comparable to humans versus these like weird creatures that are flying in the sky. And it sort of changes the way that I play the game because the first part of Crysis 3, I played through it and it was, I was having a lot of fun playing stealth.
Oh, yeah.
That like, approach.
They really encourage you to go stealth.
But then as soon as the Cephs show up, it sort of gets thrown out the window.
Because they're very feral and they come at you really hard.
And it changes what I like about the game.
I agree. The cell, interestingly, I would have, this is another game where, much like Revengeance, I think that they develop something that's really cool in the mechanic and then are too quick to move away from it. So,
yeah, like you said, with the soldiers.
I could have fought a lot more soldiers in Revengeance. And you know
what?
I could have had a lot more. I could, even in like the first 3 or 4 hours, I could have had a lot more just environmental firefight areas with the cell soldiers. Because one of the things I think that's cool when you're fighting the cell, and so the cell in Crysis 3 are the human opponents that you'll face, is that, like, granted, the AI is not intelligent in the like sense of that is an intelligent response, but it's way more intelligent than you might be accustomed to in other shooters. It's intelligent to the extent of you're in a big environment, and even though there are people who are hundreds of yards away, if you shoot someone in one of these squads, even if you're stealth and use your bow, which doesn't take you out of stealth, they notice, hey, my buddy is no longer responding to my radio. Maybe there's something fucking wrong.
Yeah. I mean, there's still issues with
now, granted, they'll all come there. They'll all come there and let you kill them. It's like, hey, Joe died over there. I'm going to go over there. Oh, shit, now I'm dead. Hey, Joe and Mike both died over there. Oh, shit, now I'm dead. Hey, Joe, Mike, and George all died over. It's like they just keep on coming over.
Yeah, it's those guys, they have great life insurance plans, I guess.
But that having been said, it's more interesting that there is a actively dynamic scenario happening, and it's not just that Joe, Mike, and George are moving around, but all the other players in the space are moving, and that really plays into this cool part of the Crysis that I'd forgotten about from one, of flipping your visor up to identify targets and then flipping it down to be back in combat mode and having to go back and forth between those two modes. Like it's like almost Metroid like
what bothers me about it is that I spent the first 3 missions of the game as the hunter Yeah. And I am hunting these guys down, and they don't know what's coming. And then the game flips
around. He's using a bow!
Yeah, like, you know, the technical advances that I've used in order to kill these people. But, and then it turns around, and all of a sudden, you become the prey to these hunters. And,
yeah.
And it just, it, for me, because it's built up that you are, they even tell you, like, you're the last one of these, you're Master Chief now. You're the last one, you're super powerful, we don't know what the fuck is going on, but now the aliens that you thought were dead, because at the end of Crisis 2, you thought everything was done, they all come back, and it's like, well, I thought I was the guy. I thought, why am I not the guy anymore?
Well, you are kind of the guy. You go from right bumpering to stealth all the time to left bumpering and armor all the time.
Yeah, I'm not cool with
it. And you don't like that as much.
No, I do not.
I think that's a perfectly valid complaint. I think that it's an interesting way that the designers chose to give you two things to play with, mm-hmm. and took you down the path of here, play with this one, and now play with this one, as opposed to finding a way to really mix and match them.
I think it would have been better if they had reversed it. If you had
armor first?
Yeah, if you had started out as being hunted and then became the hunter, I think it would have been more empowering as a player to become stronger and more powerful as the game progresses, instead of the other way around.
But that's traditional. And Andrea, I'll like the counter argument of, like, one of the things that's really cool about right off the bat in Crisis 3, you are very quickly this fucking badass who's able to hide anywhere and take out like groups of 12 or more cell troopers and be a badass. And that's pretty cool. I mean, it's pretty awesome to be like sneaking around through the environment, taking out all these troopers, being like the super stealth guy, and then very quickly you get slapped down and put in your place.
See, I don't like that. For me, games are a fantasy escape. I want to feel super powerful. I want to be the badass. I don't want to be made to feel like I'm the weak character.
Okay, so don't let me misrepresent. You know what I mean? You are in Crisis 3, you are always a badass.
Well, of course, but like, I know you said it was traditional, and I think that there's a reason why that model works, because
the build-up mechanism.
That's the way that's a payoff that a lot of people look for.
But I think it's the fact that it's so traditional and so overwrought, and like it's used so much in other games, that that's where I kind of like, I want something to be different. And that's why I thought Revengeance was refreshing, because you are awesome the whole fucking time, and you just get more awesome. It's not like you are on par with the people you're fighting in the beginning, and then you have to build up to be able to kill someone else. Like, that happens in a cutscene, and then they're like, no, you are the dude, you're awesome, go fucking kill everyone,
Jack is back,
you know what I mean? Like, I think it empowers the player to be like, yeah, you know what, I don't care if this game is going to be easy, I'll play it on the hard mode later or something, I just want to go out and destroy stuff because it's so much fun, because they are so confident in their mechanic that they don't have to tie a narrative around teaching you all of these little pieces to make you as powerful as you should be at, like, in a Metroid game.
Yeah, no, definitely. I agree with you. I think it feels awesome to be powerful all the time. Just based off what you were saying, it sounded to me like you didn't like the experience of that role reversal.
Yeah, and also I just don't like the aliens in Crisis. I find them to be super boring.
The stuff are sort of generic. I mean,
they all look like the hunters from Halo. Which in turn look like worms with, you know, like, they're all weird.
You know what I would really like?
Yeah, I want to hear what a non-generic alien would be.
A non-generic alien.
I mean, I feel like everyone now...
I'll know it when I see it. Next question.
Okay, you tell
that
me what
like
you would
someone
like.
Someone asked a question of the week this week was
since
like,
I very...
what is the PS4 game that you're excited for that's not been announced yet? And you're like, how could I
Uncharted
answer
4.
That question?
There you go. There's
but
your
it's
answer.
Like, but yeah, it was a weird
Uncharted
phrase.
4. But you were about to say...
And so,
before I cut you off, I
that's
apologize.
That's a really interesting question, but it's like it's so far afield of what we usually talk about here. But I mean, I think the thing is that too often, because of a need to identify with an audience, that we do all these anthropomorphic alien designs, right? And and it's really hard to step afield of that. If you think about some of the times, I mean, people have tried to do that, and like the one that really jumps to mind for me right now is that. Remember when they were showing the XCOM third-person adventure and they had, like, the black static enemy?
Oh, yeah. All that stuff did not work out.
It didn't work at all, right?
Well, all of the Halo enemies are essentially that. They are humanoid aliens.
Right, because it's something you can grok. It's something you can understand.
Yes!
Other than, I think,
it's too long to get to
the engineers.
Next drink. Like, people need to know the drink.
Yeah. Yes, it's true.
Other than there's like the engineers and stuff aren't like that, but in Halo, but Halo nerd time.
But having said that, yeah. I think that what is not interesting is just ramping those, just arbitrarily throwing them over the top. Like, things that don't interest me, to be frank, are like the archetypal enemies in Gears of War. Like,
yeah.
Like lizard looking dudes that are big and beefy with some
giant.
You mean
you don't like the locusts? You think they're generic?
I realize that, like, they are beloved and have a big experience around them, but like they're not, no, they don't really do that much for me. They're sort of this grimy creature thing. I get it. They fit into the mythology. They came from under the ground.
But on
a general basis, they don't do that much for me.
I feel like there's so many different types of locusts that really are diverse that I don't know. I mean, what would you compare them to?
Are you excited for playing the new Gears of War?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I'm very excited to play it.
What's the name of it?
Judgment.
Oh, you got that one.
What, did you think I didn't know?
I don't know. I just put the thoughts out of there.
Pop quiz.
So pop quiz.
He wants to know if you had the press release there next to
you. Oh, fuck you.
High five. Well done.
Oh, God. No,
I actually don't know anything about the single player of that, except that it's a prequel and is based off Baird and Cole. Well, I am more excited for the
judges.
Multiplayer.
It's like Final Fantasy, actually. There's a judge that gives you the rules for every arena, and they... That's the way it works, right?
No, no, listen. I am not even going to try to pretend that I am very knowledgeable.
Oh, I thought this was like a Phoenix Wright crossover.
Because I'm not. I love Gears of War for multiplayer, just like many people love Call of Duty for multiplayer. Even though the campaigns are fun.
I will say that I don't want to, you know, Halo does something that I think a lot of games need to do the same way, or Halo does it better, which is that their alien creatures, the enemies, are very intelligent, and the AI based on them are very strategic in the sense that they will flank and they will go after you in interesting ways. And based on, and I mean that based on different difficulty settings, they don't just throw more shit at you, they throw smarter shit at you. And I think that the thing that Crysis does that I'm not a fan of is that, like, okay, well, now these guys are really powerful, so it doesn't really matter if they're smart. We're just going to throw them at you because they're going to be really hard to take down.
So in essence, it sort of flips that equation.
Yeah.
Because the guys you face early on, although I have some complaint with how often they vocalize what they're doing, it's like these guys...
It's like Splinter Cell Conviction.
It's like flank him! It's like, okay, you just told me you're flanking me, so I'm going to go over here and look to the like where you're flanking me. But the reality is that what's cool is that all of these different enemy types do all this stuff. Like, they actually move around. They actually make you work a little bit. It's not just a guy who goes behind Concrete Barricade 7 and puts his head down and then pops up and then puts his head down and puts his head down and pops up, puts his head down, and you just wait for it to like shoot him. He'll move around. He'll look at what's going on in the environment, and there's some at least rudimentary adaptation of what they do based on what happens in the world, and that's cool.
And I think that Aliens, Colonial Marines, to go back to that for a second, kind of proved that they didn't know what they were doing when it came to those aliens, because in the movies themselves, they are proven to be very intelligent and strategic by testing the defenses of, you know, the Colonial Marines in the movies. And in the game, rather than giving you an intelligent design or intelligent enemy to face off against and have them be vicious, even one or two of them be absolutely vicious, they just run at you and lunge at you.
There's some sleestack motherfuckers. They're just like...
Argh. Whereas if you play Rebellion's Aliens versus Predator from 2010, the Colonial Marines part of that game actually is pretty good.
Really?
And the aliens in that are actually quite intelligent in comparison. So, there you go.
Smart aliens.
Interesting.
I just wish it was more like human. I'm just tired of shooting aliens. Like, you got the M rating. Let me just shoot more soldiers. Fuck them. They don't have a face. Who cares? Doesn't matter.
Did you play any Crysis multiplayer? Do you have any interest in playing Crysis multiplayer?
I don't really have any interest in playing multiplayer in general, to be honest with you.
He's like, I don't like other people.
Let me ask you a question.
It took a long time for me to get here, to be honest with you.
I've been playing shooters for a long time, and I enjoy playing shooters, although I would definitely say that my critical meter bar has risen to a degree. You know, Crysis 3 clearly passing it. Crysis 3, like, I would have no problem telling you right now, if you're on the fence and you like shooters, you should go get Crysis 3. Like, because another thing, just to backtrack before we get into multiplayer, I really like how, though, this is one of those games that to me strikes a nice balance between linear level design and a sense of being in an open environment. And I admit that, like, none of these environments they put you into are open. Yeah. There are clearly a A point and a get to a B point. But the difference to me between this and like a Call of Duty is between A and B, there's a much wider breadth of where I can go and what I can do and how I can tackle that than there is in a Call of Duty. And I really appreciate that. To me, if anything, Crysis 3 has sort of taken over what Call of Duty originally was about.
Yeah. And I want to make it clear, I haven't finished the game and I plan to play it. I mean, I bought the fucking thing, so I'm going to finish the thing as soon as I can because I think that the world is gorgeous and I like the mechanics and the bow is awesome. Like, that whole thing is great. But I went in knowing that they're probably going to fall back on the old thing of like,
I like the upgrade aliens, system. I think the upgrade system is pretty cool too. So the upgrade system they did here that's kind of clever is that you get to, it's almost like a slot machine. You have a row of four blocks. And then in each of those columns, you can add one perk. And the perks have different values for how much they cost to buy them. And then after you've bought them and placed them in your perk row, you have to unlock them in the game by satisfying a condition. So let's say that I want to get a super stealth condition. So I add super stealth, which might cost me 2 perk points. I add it into my first perk slot. And then in order to unlock it, I have to remain in stealth mode for X number of minutes, and then once I've satisfied that condition, then it unlocks, and then when I'm using that perk set, it's working. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty in-depth system that gives you a load of different options, because now for each of the face buttons, there's 4 combos. So as I'm playing through the game, I can unlock a number of different ways to tailor how I want to play Crysis to how I'm playing it. I think that's cool.
I will tell you, for a game that starts with a really long tutorial on how to shoot shit, it does not explain how to do any of what you just said.
No, I know it didn't.
That is a big problem with that game.
Like, it's all about discovery, right, guys?
Do you guys know how to look up? Have you guys ever looked up in a video game before? Oh, I played this for 20 minutes. Oh, by the way, this entire system of upgrades that's never been done before, we're not going to explain that to you. Like, it's really poorly designed.
But very early on, when you're out inside the New York jungle enviro dome, whatever the hell it is, like, you have a pretty good sense of being outdoors. But a couple of time run into the invisible walls at the edge of the area. And I thought that was that's pretty cool.
And this game, unlike Crysis 2, which I remember you saw the outdoors for about 5 minutes and then you played an entire level in the sewer. This game doesn't really fall on that all that much.
No.
I mean, there is parts of it that go underground, but you're still outside and you're interacting.
You know what I just thought of? Okay, so work with me here. Yeah. I realize this is a bit abstracted. So many, many, many years ago when I was a landscape architecture student, which I did get my degree in, I think it was our sophomore design studio, we studied zoo design. And zoo design at the era I was in was just breaking out of the whole walk through concrete alleys and look into cages thing and getting into this whole habitat movement. And the habitat thing is a really big deal because the idea of modern zoo design is that you'd be feeling as a visitor that you were in the habitat with the animals and you wouldn't perceive the walls between you and the animals. And obviously it's clearly important that you still had those walls. I mean, if it's just gorillas, you want to make sure and have those constructs so that the audience is not endangered.
It's a perception of adventure.
Right, exactly. And I feel like the level designers in sections of Crysis really get that same idea of using those visual and environmental tricks to fool you sensorily into feeling like you have this expansive world, feeling like you're in the midst of things when there might be an artificial wall mere meters away from you, but you don't ever worry about going to get to it because they've pulled off the entirety of the experience.
And it's designed really well where you don't really find that you want to go beyond certain points because you see how the geometry kind of unfolds and it wouldn't make sense for you to go in a specific direction.
Yeah.
So the flow of it works very well because you always kind of know where you need to be going because
exactly.
The geometry is presented in a very cohesive and simplistic way.
And they're also really good at giving you these up close details, right? So like when you're in a space, when you're in a room of some abandoned part of New York City, it's not just unfurnished and it's not just furnished a little bit. There's like all kinds of stuff there. There's, you know, the broken down furniture and they're the things that would be on the furniture. And then there's like the moss growing through the cracks and all of those things that help furnish that area. So you feel like you're in a real space and it's not just a contrivance that's like trying to be the next box before you move on to the next box. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's really well done.
Zoo design. Very fascinating.
Zoo design is like has all kinds of other stuff, but like but it does relate to zoo design because the same thing happens. Like when you go to the San Diego Zoo and you go to visit, say,
the tigers,
the tigers, the idea of modern zoo design is that you feel like you're there in the savanna with the tigers. And clearly I can't have that happening, but I have to hide the division between you and the tiger so that you feel like you're there with the tigers. So you have this sort of immersive experience of I'm here with the tigers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, everything you were saying was very reminiscent of Randy Pitchford's talk that he gave at DICE. Did you see his DICE talk? Video games are magic?
They are magic.
They are. It was really, I thought it was really fascinating. It was really interesting that a lot of what you said paralleled.
Well, I'm thinking of a number. Do you have it?
He did the red cards versus blue cards trick.
Do you have it?
It's number 9.
It is number 9. How did you know? Oh my God.
I'm just a genius. Jesus. I do really would love, I would love to talk about Zav's block if we have time.
I'd like to talk about Zav's block too. Have you seen his block?
Well, that's a very
I'm uncomfortable right now.
Question.
Everyone. Well, is this the last segment or do we have another segment?
We can do another segment because we never talked about Crysis Multiplayer, which I wanted to bring
up. We were
just
talking about Crysis Multiplayer.
We didn't talk about multiplayer. I haven't played multiplayer either, which leads to the discussion.
So we should talk about something we haven't played. That sounds awesome.
Well,
great plan.
Exactly.
I'd like to subscribe to your newsletter.
Have you listened to the show before? What I wanted to get to was that I don't think I'm developing fatigue for shooters because I still do enjoy them, although I like to play a lot of other games. I do think, though, that I'm in a weird spot with multiplayer online shooters and that I don't really care to go play Crysis because I don't really think there's going to be a population base there and there's nothing that's turned me on about like, oh, I want to go play that. Yeah. But I no longer really want to go just run around in loops and shoot people in Call of Duty.
Yeah, I know.
So you want to play Mass Effect multiplayer?
I played it for a while.
New DLC out we could talk about.
I think it's going to take something very special to kind of rope me in. Some things do it. Like Hawken, for example, kind of roped me in.
That's cool.
Because it was a different experience and I kind of like fell in love with the ability to like, hey, if I want to create this mech myself, I could do it. Or, you know, there's the free-to-play model that's available to that stuff too. I recently interviewed Ming Lee from... he's at Fix Korea. He was one of the co-founders or co-creators of Counter-Strike, who is working on a new game called Tactical Intervention, which there's a beta starting on Monday for it that you can get codes for. And I played a little bit of that, and that is like Counter-Strike, but then it has all this other really cool shit attached to it.
Was Tactical Intervention an Unreal mod once upon a day?
No, it was. It's always been a Source. I think it was. Now it's a Source powered title. Okay. He started working on the game as soon as he left Valve. When him and Jess Cliff, Counter-Strike became part of Valve, those two guys who made Counter-Strike worked for Valve. He left Valve in 2006, started working on this game. It's been like 6 years since he started working on this game. It's a free-to-play game that's coming out, and it's essentially Counter-Strike. But what they're doing also is there's a mission where you are you have a VIP in a car that you need to drive to an exit point, and the terrorists are in other vehicles chasing you down on streets, like streets with other traffic. You're going through traffic, you're going over bridges, and you're shooting at the car.
Pretty rad.
And you're the terrorists have a helicopter that's following this chase. And what you're supposed to do is kill the VIP, take the briefcase from him, hook it to the helicopter flies away. Like, that's one mission in this game.
That's
and
cool.
It's pretty fucking
you're getting
awesome.
Me psyched up. I'm getting like excited now. My eyes
and
are
there's,
open.
And there's like tactical roles and stuff, and like, you know, you when you're fighting a guy, if he's shooting at you, you can like hit a button and roll out of the way, and there's dogs that you can send out to chew people's asses off. You know, there's like a lot of little things like that, and then they have other modes that
you
are
lost me a little
out.
Bit with the dogs, by the way.
Well, I mean, like the dogs are cool because you can throw in smoke grenades and then send your dogs into a room. If there are terrorists or counter-terrorists there, they'll attack the counter-terrorists who can't see anything because there's smoke in the room. Like, there's stuff like that. It's really interesting, and I think that not that I'm embracing free-to-play all that much because I'm not a huge fan of that model, but I think that it's the risks that I think some of these other guys are taking to make innovations out of stuff that we already know. Like, it's really hard to innovate a first-person shooter. So how do you do that? You do that with new modes. Like,
true.
That driving mode is a little bit like the original Team Fortress 1 VIP mode 2, except in that mode, there was a person who was actually the VIP. This is AI-generated. But, I mean, like, that stuff, I think, interests me a little bit more in terms of multiplayer.
Well, let me tell you what. As someone who's now deep in the weeds of trying to design good, freemium, pay models that make a good game for both the player and the developer. It is not at all easy. It is not at all easy at all. Anyway, let's take a little break. When we come back on the other side, we can talk about that. We can talk about Zav's block or whatever else you want to. We'll have finishing moves, and we'll wrap this sucker up for Weekend Confirm number 154. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Andrea's all like ready to get down.
You look like a friend of mine.
You're totally getting down. All right, so
grooving, man, grooving.
Always got the grooving tunes, of course. So microtransactions and free-to-play models, obviously a big part of what we do in mobile. Something I've had my head in now for several months, and I really am not surprised at how many less thoughtful designs come out, because it's like I was talking to Zav. It's like, you know, it's like reviews. It's very easy to write the really glowing review. It's really easy to write the bad review. But the mama bear review, it's really hard. And the mama bear of free-to-play models is really hard. It's really difficult to try and engineer a system. And I'm really glad, like, the mobile developers I'm working with are awesome, because we're thinking about these things from the outset. But, like, how do you make a system that works within your game so that it's like part and parcel of your design? It's not intrusive. It's not an impediment. It's not something that's really annoying to your player. It's something that still lets the player enjoy the game and have a good time playing the game. And at the same time, will ultimately result in a pay structure that will let the developer make some money off the work they put into it. It's really hard. And I'm not sure that even at the highest level of developer right now, or publisher, that people get it. For instance, so EA this week, their CFO, Blake Jorgensen, was presenting at Morgan Stanley's Technology, Media, and Telecom Conference, and he said this: the next and much bigger piece is microtransactions within games. We're building into all of our games the ability to pay for things along the way, either to get to a higher level, to buy a new character, to buy a truck, a gun, whatever it might be, and consumers are enjoying and embracing that way of business. Well, wait, they are? Like, they're
enjoying and embracing it are two very
I don't think they're enjoying and embracing
words.
Any of it.
Yeah.
And what pisses me off about this is that that's the sort of manipulative bullshit that the audience of gamers calls out, and rightfully so calls out, because it is exploitive. And that's that lowest common denominator. That is the bad thing. That's the Candy Crush level of it. That's the, hey, if I want to do something in a game that's super manipulative and like gets people to pay a lot of money into the system, yeah, I can do that. Mm-hmm. Sure, it's easy. It's really easy to slap a lot of gates in the way of a player progression. It's really easy to slap a lot of places in there where I can say, like, oh yeah, you want to get that? It looks cool, doesn't it? That'll be $5. Yeah. I can do that all day long. Like, that's not hard.
Well, Real Racing 3 came out today.
It did.
And
that's an interesting conversation right there.
And now that it's part of EA's umbrella, it is a free-to-play game, whereas the original two games in the franchise were just games that you would buy, and they were a little bit more expensive than your typical iOS game. And now they have a freemium model in there, and you can purchase things like, you know, upgrades for your vehicles and all these other things that you can do.
Dude, they've gone time gating. They've gone progress gating.
Here's my favorite one. And I haven't played it yet. This is Mike Schramm was talking about this today on the Joystick Podcast, was saying that if you upgrade your engine, you tell the game, okay, I've bought a new engine, so I want to put it in my car. Now, you can't race your car with that engine yet, because it needs to put the engine in the car. So then you have to pay the game to speed that process up or wait 3 or 4 minutes.
That's time gating.
Yeah.
That's pure time gating.
And it's the worst offender of that. And this is, and I want, I'm really glad that you're here. I don't know why you wouldn't be, but I actually, the last couple of times I've been here, you weren't. But the thing that I wanted to ask you was, why isn't there, in the sense of like Real Racing, I like that series and I'd be willing to pay, you know, the $19 or whatever for it, let's say, to get all that stuff unlocked. How come that is not ever a part of the freemium model? And I'll tell you why it you don't make any more money for me. Because if I like a game within 5 minutes, maybe I'll buy some stuff. Maybe I'll spend $2-3 on it. But if in that 5 minutes I can then spend $10 to unlock the whole thing, you've got $10 for me. But after a week, I typically stop playing that thing. And then you've only received maybe a dollar, maybe 10 cents for me. Like, it is the impulse for me to just unlock everything as a full retail product is more in it. It's more of a, it's a better experience for me than it would be for me to buy things piecemeal.
Because now we're into stupid.
You're totally right. I totally agree with you, Zav, 100%.
But now we're into.
I want the record to show that I'm totally right.
Now we're into economies, totally right. and we're into an economics discussion and a marketing discussion, which is that's great because if I get $10 out of you instead of 20, I'm happy. Because by structuring the game the way I did, your $10 is still contributing to my average revenue per user going up, and I'm going to be $6, $7, $8 average revenue per user. And by being free to play, instead of having 30, 40, 50, 100,000 users, I'm going to have 300, 500, a million users. And I'd rather make $6, $7, $8 per average off of them than 20 off of a smaller sample set.
I think Naughty
that's
Dog.
That's the economics of it.
Naughty Dog is trying it this way themselves because Uncharted 3 multiplayer is now free to play
up to level 15. It's a different. There's a different model. There's a lot of different models in the space too.
Sure.
That's the other thing is free to play is very quickly matured, and just lumping them all in the same bucket is not.
No,
is
but
not accurate
in comparison to what I'm saying that I wish all free to play games did and just unlocked an entire like retail experience. I could go play free to play Uncharted right now and buy everything piecemeal for, you know, $2-3 at a pop, or I can just go buy the Game of the Year edition and I have everything there for $30.
May I go back to your original question?
Sure.
Your original question was Real Racing 3.
Yeah.
Why don't I offer, if I'm the publisher, why don't I offer you, Zav, a version that's $20 and unlocks everything? Mm-hmm. And the reason I don't offer you that version is sadly a manipulative move in that I know that if I offered $20 to unlock everything, I'd be capping the maximum anybody ever spent at $20. And I know that if I capture millions of people playing the game, there'll be a small percentage of people who will spend more than $20. And they'll spend more than $50. And they might even spend more than $100. And by capturing that audience, I'm getting all that money into my system. And that's the dirty side. That's what I'm saying is frustrating. Like it's really easy to make that sort of system. It's also easy to screw up. I mean, you look at like what the Punch Quest guys did. It's also really easy to make a system that's very player friendly and results in a game that's a blast to play, but never winds up getting anyone to pay anything for it.
But look at the most successful free-to-play games on iOS specifically.
Okay.
It would be something like
Clash of Clans. Number one revenue grossing game right now.
Okay, what kind of game is it? I've never actually heard of it.
Clash of Clans is a twist on management and tower defense where you're building like your own little clan city.
Okay.
It's like a clan encampment. And then you also send your enemies. You also send your warriors out to go attack other people's clans. So it's like tower defense. You build up your defenses in the tower defense part. You also drop your guys on enemies and attack their tower defenses.
Fairly casual, would you say it's a casual game?
Pretty casual. Pure time gating in that as you get very quickly as you get into building your cities, mm-hmm. you run into this like to upgrade your cannon is going to cost a day, or you can spend gems, which by the way cost you money.
Well, Tiny Tower is a good example of a microtransaction in iOS space too that was really successful.
Jetpack Joyride went that route. After a while, it became a free-to-play game, and you can unlock boosters and things like that.
Although right now,
nature.
If you look at the ones that are top grossing in the iTunes store, especially in the iTunes store, you're looking at games that are mostly they're pretty tough-spirited. And, you know, Candy Crush Saga is another one of those ones that's way up there right now, and it's because it's a simple match three game that very quickly pushes you into needing to use bonuses and power-ups and then, by the way, says, oh, those are going to cost money.
Yeah. Well, my point is it seems like the most successful versions of this working are those casual experiences for the casual player. And I think companies like EA, what they're doing is they're trying to translate that into the same type of experience for a hardcore game.
Yes.
And that's where I think they're falling apart. They're like, it works for this whole segment. There's a whole segment of people who are just dying to give us money, but that whole segment is not dying to play real racing. You know what I mean? Like, it sort of reminds me of, like, THQ had a kind of a brilliant idea with the MX series to release a cheaper version of their racing game and sell stuff piecemeal. It just wasn't the right game to test that with.
I agree. And so I agree so much, because I think the other piece, and this is something that I hope, you know, that I hope to help change in the games we're working on, is that the mobile space mentality right now applies to, when I get you as a player, I want to milk you for as much as I can, as quickly as I can, because I probably am not going to have you as a user in a couple of 3 weeks, because none of the games are thinking about long-term value. And I'm all about, like, thinking about, like, hey, look, this is a good game and I'm going to play it for a long time. Then let me play it for a long time. Then give me a reason to keep playing it. And that means that my monetization, if I'm free to play, and I expect you to play it for more than a couple of weeks, then I can't be setting up a system that is just going to, like, lay you out and take all your money out of your wallet in the first 2 weeks, because by the end of 2 weeks, you'll be like, holy Christ, this game's taken $20 from me.
Yeah, and it's...
That's also not a good relationship.
It's also about drawing out the experience by providing supplementary content, which, you know, a game like World of Tanks has been really successful at, and the reason why that game has really exploded...
Well, I need to play World of Tanks.
League of Legends has also been great.
Yeah, absolutely, because...
League of Legends is a little different.
Their business model is different.
Their business model is different.
It's because they provide these content updates that really give the player a bang for their buck, you know, for lack of a better comparison. Like, because they get in at such a low ground level, and then they want to keep coming back because the developers keep giving them more content that excites them.
I feel like it's such a psychological game of, you know, how are we going to mess with people and try to trick them into giving us this money. It never seems like it's fair to the consumer.
For some folks, it really is, Dav. I mean, that's the sad truth of it. For some outlets, it really is about that. They're really in it just to make the buck.
It's like, it reminds me of, like, that the whole free to play stuff in the MMO space. And there, you know, there are legitimate concerns of people, like, spending money out of compulsion that end up, you know, going into debt for things like this. And it's just, it's a business model. It's like, well, we gave you the warnings. Like, you know, it doesn't really matter to the company itself. I mean, I feel like it's the wrong game to do it for me. And the reason why I wish I could just buy Real Racing 3 is because I really like Real Racing 2. And I really like playing that game.
You should, by the way. It's 2 gigs, so you'll need 4 gigs on your iPad to install it, because the way that works. But you should. The downside is, just according to Touch Arcade, just following through the core experience unlocks, you'll have to play 500 hours to unlock the game without playing.
I feel like...
Without paying.
Without paying, yes.
I just wanted to make sure that not 500 playing. Hours without paying to unlock
everything.
Yes, I said playing.
Yes, you can...
I'm only repeating it because it's a little shocking. Like, that's a lot of hours.
But it also means that you paid absolutely nothing for all the work they put into the game.
But that's ridiculous. 500 hours?
How is it ridiculous? You paid nothing. You paid... Nothing. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
You have a very fair point. If you paid nothing, that's a lot of hours.
How many of those hours are me waiting for shit to happen?
All of them.
You know what I mean?
That's the basic system they're using.
Telling me that there's 500 hours worth of content in there is not.
Oh, I'm saying 500 hours worth of playing. Like, no, oh, worth I'm, of playing. I'm okay. a side. 500 hours worth of playing plus. In addition to, you have to wait 12 hours for this to happen. Or you have to wait 1,000.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's like those gates that they put in front of me to entice me to continue by giving them a couple of dollars.
So
only strives to frustrate me as a gamer.
So let's play the median developer thing. Dav, what would you tell me to do? Because here's in my mind, when I'm looking at the games we're working on, what I want to achieve. I want to achieve a relationship with the player where we're able to build a game that you can go out and get and play, and if you like it, you wind up spending some money with us, and because you spent some money with us, then we're able to keep developing the game, and we keep building on the game, and the game gets better and better, and then over time, there's more opportunities where if you keep playing the game, you play, and there's a good symbiotic relationship there where, you know, the players are playing money, the developer is making some money, and the game is existing and moving forward.
For me, I mean, when I played Jetpack Joyride, it was when it already went free to play, and the reason why I bought the 99-cent booster to get double coins was because, hey, I really like this game. Half Break makes really good games. I want to give them money. It's just 99 cents, but I want to give them money. So I think one of the things that, companies do now that I don't enjoy, and like Tactical Intervention is doing this too, where you don't actually buy content from the game. You're renting it from the game, where you're renting a weapon for 24 hours. Like, I mean, at this point now, I can't even buy the stuff I want to. I need to unlock it after playing way too much to get a minimal upgrade, or pay you $3 to not
even own
something.
So there are games experimenting with that. I'm not sure that that theory will...
That's a bad theory.
I don't think that theory will actually wind up working in the Western world, because I agree with you. I don't think that Western gamers are going to accept the rental idea. It has worked in Europe, though.
That's something that I feel really strongly about, which leads me to kind of steer this conversation about microtransactions away from just free-to-play, because microtransactions are also becoming much more prevalent in pay-to-play games.
By the way, that's what the EA's CFO was talking about. He was talking about including pay-to-win, which is the most offensive to us as gamers, in a $60 game. Here's a $60 game. Well, by the way, you can also pay...
Dead Space 3 had microtransactions
Dead Space 2,
in
Dead Space
it,
3,
you know?
All of the EA sports games do it.
And one of my biggest complaints that I've made on this very show multiple times about Mass Effect 3, a franchise and a game that I love dearly, is that in the multiplayer, there is a giant paywall, and you have even said to me, well, you can earn the points. And I say, yeah, you can never earn enough points to unlock everything, because it's a random unlocking. And a lot of that stuff that you pay to unlock, either you pay with your time or you pay with your dollars, is consumable and then it's gone. And that to me is so criminally offensive that you would charge people $3 to unlock a pack of 5 medigels that you could use in 5 different rounds and be done with it.
Yeah, consumables are a big problem. Skylanders is doing that.
Is it offensive to you because you paid $60 for the game?
Yes. I paid $100 for the collector's edition, actually, which was my choice, you know.
Had the game been free, how would you feel about that?
I would feel differently about it. I would feel like it's my choice, and the developer has to make their money back.
That right there is why free to play will not be going anywhere, is because the $60 that you and everyone else who bought the game spent will be so quickly outstripped by the average revenue per player of a free to play game. Because if I'm free, I can get so many people playing my game, and then I can get the, and then as long
yeah,
as I
you
do
remove
the
barrier of entry.
And well, as long as I do the right, as long as I pull the right tricks to get my average revenue per user up where I need it to be, I can make way more money.
No, I agree. I think the thing that, yeah, the tricks are what's really frustrating, and particularly with what EA is doing with Mass Effect multiplayer, what's frustrating for me as a player is that, you know, it's random. I don't get to pay to unlock a specific thing. I pay to spin the wheel.
But do you want to be able to pay to unlock a thing? I mean, here's the whole thing.
Yes, I do. When I pay to unlock a character, I want to pick the character.
I'm saying
at least
philosophically,
want to know that I'm going to get a character that I don't already have.
Oh, I agree. But I'm saying philosophically, if I'm buying a $60 game and there's a multiplayer experience, I don't want to have to pay extra for all those things.
I agree.
Like, there is a nickel and it's not even nickel and diming at that point. It's like, which way do you want to go, folks? Do you want to go down the I'm going to make you get my game free and then I'm going to charge you for different things? Or do you want to charge me for the game? Because if you're charging me for the game, then I feel like, you know what? You got my money up front. It's the way the economy. You want my money up front, then you have to deliver a little more for me. You want my money as a trickle, then that's fine if you're willing to take that risk. But that means you're going to have to keep delivering, and then I'll keep buying in.
Although not a microtransaction in a sense, it is still downloadable content. Retail games have been doing this over the last year and a half with season passes.
Mm-hmm.
Now you get to pre-order all the shit that we promise we're going to make for it. And like, you don't know the quality of these products, but you get a slight discount on it. A good offender of a bad season pass would be Saints Row the Third. Had terrible DLC, in my opinion. And, you know, you pay...
Aliens Colonial Marines has a season pass.
Is there a season pass for
there
Aliens
is.
Colonial Marines?
BioShock Infinite has a season pass coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, now it's like the game's not even out yet.
My mom
pre-ordered
has a season,
the season pass. Like, at this point, we don't even know exactly what this content's going to be. I mean, I feel like a game like Halo or Call of Duty, I think you at least understand what you're going to get out of it because it's map packs. Like, what are they going to do with BioShock? Like, you want me to give you $30 on top of the money I'm going to spend on the game before I even know what it is that you're going to make for it?
stuff.
It's going too far. And in the next generation, with much bigger hard drives and more snappy interfaces and great marketplaces, it's only going to get worse.
Snappy interfaces and great marketplaces, all of them in our faces.
It's frustrating. It's frustrating being a gamer and feeling like you're being nickel and dimed all the time, especially when you see DLC that you know should have been included in the main campaign or the main multiplayer on the disc, and you see it, like the Omega DLC for Mass Effect 3, you know, got this exact criticism. Like, why was that just not included with the game?
Yeah.
It's happening with all kinds of games from all kinds of publishers, and as a gamer, this is an expensive passion and hobby to have. It's really, really tough.
But because you're so passionate, they feel like they can get more out of you.
I know, and it sucks, and we keep paying. we're not helping ourselves.
I will say, speaking to a lot of developers who are going this route and kind of being pushed into this section by their publishers, they're not too happy about it. They don't want to make a game like that. They want to make a game that you're going to love, and they don't want to throw barriers in your way, at least from the people that I've spoken to about
this.
No,
the developers, everyone, I agree, everyone that I've talked to has been fantastic.
These are business decisions. They
always point the finger at the marketing department. So,
yeah.
Look, so it's frustrating. I would agree with that. I would say, though, that, I mean, look, I have not come across a single developer who didn't really really cherish and love their design ideas, and they want them to be successful. And part of that successfulness is, you know, finding a way to make a viable living out of it so they can keep their studio going, so they can keep
Design, I don't think, ever has to do
I don't think so. Right. But then you have to figure out how to work it. And then this comes back to the thing that I started us off with, is that it's really, really tough when you start talking. Because, look, here's the deal. Up until very recently, making the game and selling the game were completely separated from one another. Oh. There was a team making the game. They made the game. They made the game. They finished the game. They put it on the disc. The disc went to the marketing team. Marketing PR team, then there was their responsibility. They would go sell the game. But if we're talking about free-to-play, suddenly we're talking about mechanisms for revenue that are now sending their tendrils down into the game. And the only way to do that that works from my perspective is to have it designed into the game and be part of that creative vision. And now suddenly you've got to think about that when you're balancing the game and when you're thinking about the player experience. And yeah, you've also got to stand up to your publisher or your marketing team and go like, no, we know what, we're not going to just milk them. We're not just going to do this because we think we've got a great game. We've got a game that people will play for more than 2 weeks. We got a game people will play for 2 months and 10 months and 2 years.
I think that's going to hurt tactical intervention.
I hope not.
And
I hope we all figure out how to work with it. I mean, there's a lot of ways this could go. I hope we all figure out how to work with it.
I will say very quickly that that game had been in development for many years before they signed on with OG Planet to create a free-to-play game. And they had to go back and, you're right, had to go in and build systems within the design of the game to compensate for the free-to-play business model that they were still developing and trying to conceive of, and they still haven't finalized.
Time for finishing moves.
It's the weekend, and it's time for finishing moves.
Yeah, such a happy intro that I feel sad saying this, but if you would like to read one of Jeff Mattis's last awesome pieces, you can check out his Tomb Raider review, single player review, that's up on Shack News. And Joystick has their review coming, you said,
I believe it's this week.
This week?
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated. So the early consensus on Tomb Raider is that it's good and people are really enjoying it. And that leaves me really torn, because the subtext to this is that it is absolutely, as a webcomic that I saw earlier with Indiana Jones standing between Lara Croft on one side and Nathan Drake on the other side, become another of these action archaeologist games. There you go.
You just created a subgenre. Activision would be proud of you.
I know, right? And, you know, I'm not sure how to respond to that. I mean, I'm excited that the new Lara is cool, and I think it's awesome. It has a great engine, and I think it's really cool that they've made a good game around it. At the same time, I think there was something that there was a place that Tomb Raider, when it was successful, filled, that the reimagined early Tomb Raider was filling. Like, it had gotten back to it. Tomb Raider 1 and 2 were great, and then after that, Core really dropped the ball. But the revitalization of Tomb Raider had worked, and I don't think that they had to go and do this to make Tomb Raider successful. I think that there was still an interesting space where the game mechanic was something more than just what's been done. And it's awesome that people are loving it. It's awesome that it's doing really well. I kind of still, regardless of how I find it when I play it, which I absolutely will play it as a huge, huge Lara fan. I'm a huge Lara fan. There's no way I'm not going to play it. I'll probably enjoy it. I just wonder what could have been. I think that's really what I'm saying. I just wonder what could have been.
Interesting finishing move.
What could have been?
I want to respond, but I don't think I'm allowed to on finishing moves.
You're welcome to... I want to say, I think
people have the same perception of Splinter Cell Conviction and how that wasn't a Splinter Cell game.
True.
So rather than enjoy what they received, they lamented what they did not receive.
And to be clear, my point, I guess, of this finishing move is that despite my predetermined, like, internal force to want to be Lara the way I wanted to, that I've been away from it long enough and have read the reviews now that I kind of want to play Lara. I want to play this new Tomb Raider and just enjoy it for what it is, and I'm cool with that.
Sounds good.
Who would like to go next?
I'll go next. So as we mentioned earlier, I've been doing this show for a while now, and this is the first time that I've ever had like a big call to action, but I want to let the audience know that I am participating this weekend in the Walk with Sally Bowl of Prom. And what this is Walk with Sally is a charity that helps children who are affected by a death in the family due to cancer. And it gives them a mentor to kind of help them through dealing with the loss in their family. And I'm doing a fundraiser, and I have lots of information if you guys would be interested in donating, even if you only have $1 or $5 or $10 or any dollars you have. It's a really great program, and you can go find the link information. Dave will put it in the show notes, and you can also go to my website, AndreaRenee.com, and find more information about Walk with Sally. It's going to be really fantastic, and I would really appreciate any and all support that I could get from you guys, so it'd be great.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, thank you very much, guys, for having me.
Of course.
Darn it. I haven't seen you in a long time. It's been fun.
It's nice that I'm actually here.
It's always fun to argue with you sometimes, you know? I miss this rapport.
The banter.
I do want to say that it's sad that Jeff Mattis isn't here, and Ryan as well. Two great guys. And obviously, I know you guys are going to miss them. Man, I feel like a asshole shilling now, but
shill away.
The Super Joystick podcast, which we do every Thursday, you can watch live on joystick.com. We do it via Google Hangout. You can watch it on YouTube.
Oh, you can video that shit.
Yeah, we do it all live video, so you can watch the show. We did it this afternoon at 12 noon Pacific, and that's the typical time that we do it. And also, I did a huge piece with Ming and the Fix Korea guys about tactical intervention. You can read that preview. And on Monday on joystick.com, we are giving away 6,000 beta codes, and it's beta exclusive to readers of Joystick. So if you want to get into the beta, all you have to do is go to Joystick, and that is the only place you'll find beta codes. So check out the game. It's I'm not too thrilled about the business model, but I think the game plays really well.
You can tactically intervent a joystick.
You can, and that information will be on our Twitter, which is at joystick with a Q.
Oh, and I should probably mention that this is my last show of Weekin Confirmed as an employee of Machinima.
No.
Yes.
What?
I am officially leaving Machinima.
So next week, will you tell us what you think about Need for Speed?
Don't bring the PR, though. I mean, leave that at home, please. The stack of paper you bring is
ridiculous. I liked Need for Speed, okay? And EA never paid me a fucking dollar to say anything about that. So anyone that believes that I was paid to talk about Need for Speed can get fucked.
We didn't get a chance to do my block, but hopefully you'll have me on one more time.
And, we talked about your block a little bit.
Yeah, I want to talk about the PR machine.
Oh, God.
We'll do that. That's a whole new episode.
That is a whole new episode.
Yes,
another
indeed.
Time.
Indeed.
All right, big thanks to the Atlantis group, who was very accommodating today as we were a little late running. Brooklyn here is our engineer again.
Yay,
because she's back in town.
Yay!
That's all, folks. That is your Weekin Confirmed, and we are Ghost. Work so hard that
I bring a pulsating to the sound. Hey, bartender, hear me with another round. I gotta finish, she's ready.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/weekendconfirmed.